Chapter 15. Nadezhda Yakovlevna, Tuesday, the 28th of May, 1934. I did a great many things in the days after Mandelstam's arrest that recommended themselves to me as a way to make an hour or two pass without agonizing over Mandelstam's arrest. One day I scrubbed the kitchen pots and the single grill of the paraffin stove with steel wool until my fingers turned raw. Another time I pranced around the small living room, crushing moths between my palms and keeping score with chalk marks on a piece of slate. I spent an entire weekend mending garments with wrong-colored threads. Working by candlelight one night, I made copies of the poems we'd hidden in my shoes and gave the duplicates to Mandelstam's brother, Alexander, for safekeeping. The night of Mandelstam's arrest, they had searched through all of our books and then flung them back onto the shelves in disorder. On the day in question, I decided to restore them to something resembling the order they had been in, dusting each book as it came off the shelf, stacking my husband's in one pile and mine in another before returning them to the shelves. It is a law of nature that one never sorts books without pausing now and then to skim through the pages, wondering who underlined certain passages and why, wondering who scribbled illegible notes in the margins with arrows pointing to other paragraphs. I reread sentences I'd underlined in an excellent Russian translation of Laclos's 18th-century masterpiece, Les Liaisons Dangereuses. I came across another book that I'd thought I'd loaned and lost, Zinovieva Annibal's 33 Monstrosities, a novel from the turn of the century that for the first time in modern Russian literature openly described lesbian love. I don't recall how the book came into my possession, but I do recall when. I was 16 at the time, with a terrible crush on a Russian girl I'd met in Paris while travelling with my parents. She had slipped me notes on perfumed paper, saying how much she admired my pale eyes and my delicate skin. Curiously, I can't even remember the girl's name now, though this puppy love was as intense as any I'd experienced before Mandelstam mooched that first cigarette from me in the junk shop. Perhaps this girl had given me the 33 monstrosities. On the other hand, it could well have been my mother, one of the first females in all of Russia to qualify as a physician. She had a bohemian disposition and could conceivably have left the book on my night table to impart to her Kiev-bound daughter a patina of sophistication. I was leafing through 33 monstrosities, lingering over the pages where the corners had been turned down at one time or another, trying in vain to read them with the eyes of the 16-year-old daydreamer I once was, when I heard footsteps beating a hasty retreat in the corridor outside the flat. Going into the hallway, I couldn't help but spot the folded paper that had been slipped under the door. My heart started pounding in my ribcage when I picked it up. For a moment I was too frightened of what might be in it to unfold the paper and see. Pasternak had phoned several days before to say that he had learned, he absolutely refused to tell me how, that Stalin himself was taking a personal interest in Mandelstam's case. Pasternak interpreted the information as a positive development, but I saw the dark side of this moon. If Stalin was taking a personal interest in Mandelstam, God have mercy on Mandelstam. Curiosity got the better of me, and I unfolded the paper, which turned out to be a printed summons, with my name inked in, to turn up at the Forkosovsky Street door of the Lubyanka at 2 that same afternoon. The Lubyanka? Was I then being arrested? Or did this have to do with my husband? Were they going to hand me a death certificate and his personal effects? I remember that my legs gave way under me and I sank onto the floor, kneeling before the rose-red radiator, as if it were a religious artifact and I were praying to it. Dear God in heaven, if he still has a muse and an erection, arrange things so the sun will simply fail to rise tomorrow morning. Amen. After a time, I managed to collect my strength and my thoughts enough to make it to the communal telephone in the corridor and dial Bukharin's Izvestia number. I reached his secretary, Korotkova. "Oh, dear," she said with a despondent sigh. "He has absolutely forbidden me to put through a call from you, Madame Mandelstam. He won't see you if you come by. He is furious with you. You apparently placed Nikolai Ivanovich in an awkward position vis-à-vis his friend in the Kremlin. I am afraid there is nothing I can do for you." To say I was shaken would be an understatement. One of the Herzen House neighbors found me sitting on the broken chair next to the telephone, staring numbly at the wall. "Nadezhda, have you heard bad news?" she asked. I handed her the summons. She read it and said, "God help you, I cannot," and crushed it back into my fingers as if the paper were contaminated before beating a hasty retreat. It occurred to me that I should call Akhmatova, my worldly wise friend, who knew if you delivered packages to prisons you could discover where your husband was being held. I fell on Lev, Anna Andreevna's son by her first husband, Gumilyov, who promised me he would have his mother ring me back the instant she returned from the gastronome. I sat there for I don't know how long before the telephone rang under my fingers. I snatched it from the cradle. It was, thank heaven, Akhmatova. I quickly read the summons to her over the phone. As usual, she considered the matter carefully before delivering her opinion. "I think we can rule out that they have summoned you to tell you he is dead," she said finally. "From what I hear, you only learn of the death of a prisoner when a package or a letter is returned with the word deceased stamped on it. Very occasionally some kind soul writes in the cause of death, though the death of a prisoner, even the ones shot in the basements of the Lubyanka, is almost always attributed to heart failure. On rare occasions the authorities send a formal notice listing the date on which the prisoner is said to have died."
"If he is dead, what do they do with the body?"
"I have heard the prisoners who aren't cremated are buried in a common grave on the Butovo shooting range outside of Moscow, next to the dachas they built for Czechists. But be reassured, Nadezhda, it is extremely unlikely they would summon you to announce Mandelstam's death. I can't rule out you will be arrested. I understand they are arresting so many people these days they don't have enough Czechists to bring them in. The less important political prisoners are summoned to save Czechist manpower for the more important prisoners. On the other hand, it might be something entirely different. One cannot abandon hope entirely that Pasternak or Bukharin somehow got word to Stalin and Osip is being given a prison sentence. The thing to watch for, if this is the case, is the notation without the right of correspondence after the prison term. Without the right of correspondence is the equivalent of a death sentence. It means they are cutting the prisoner off from civilization because they don't expect him to return. There is still another possibility, that Osip will be sent into exile, what they call the famous minus 12, in which case they would need you to bring foodstuff for the journey and clothing for the winter. Anna corrected herself. Or winters, plural, ahead.
"I never thought I would pray to God for Mandelstam to be sent into exile," I said.
"It would be the least terrible resolution," she agreed. "I will add my voice to yours on the off chance there is an Almighty and he is listening."
"Will they permit me to accompany him into exile?"
"If it is exile, probably. More and more wives are going into exile with their husbands these days. It frees up flats. It gets nuisances like us out of eyeshot. What time are you supposed to turn up at Lubyanka?"
2.
"Dearest Nadezhda, I shall camp by the telephone," Akhmatova informed me. "If you don't call back by 5, I shall inform Pasternak, and the both of us will start bombarding the Writers' Union with telegrams demanding to know what happened to you." Which is how I found myself standing before a nondescript door on Fourkasovsky Street,
looking for a bell to ring or a knocker to strike against the wood. Mandelstam would surely have burst into laughter if he could have seen me, trying to figure out how to get into the Lubyanka. In the end, I wound up rapping the joints of my fingers against the door. A young Czechist in the blue uniform of a frontier guard opened it the width of a fist so that I could see only one of his eyes peering at me. "Well?" I slipped my summons through the crack to him. He closed the door in my face. I stood there trying to figure out if I should knock again or wait. Women passing on the sidewalk, each carrying an arvoska filled with oranges, glanced at me. I wondered if they were aware that this was a back door to the dreaded Lubyanka prison. After a moment the door opened again, this time wide enough for me to pass through. I heard it being slammed shut and locked with a bolt behind me. I had all to do to keep from sinking again to my knees.
"Follow," the guard ordered.
"Where are you taking me?" I asked, but he had already hurried off, and I had to run to catch up with him. We passed through yet another door into a courtyard, then up steps and through yet another door into an elegant entranceway filled with mirrors set into the walls and a tiled floor so polished one could see the hem of one's skirt in it. A wide staircase with a mahogany banister curled up from the entranceway. The guard led me past the staircase to a large mirrored elevator. He handed my summons to the elevator operator, an elderly gentleman wearing white gloves and a blue tunic with gold braid and brass buttons. I got in and through force of habit glanced at myself in the mirror. My complexion alone was enough to frighten off the devil, who, we all assumed, lurked in the shadows inside the Lubyanka. I tucked stray hairs back under the beret that my parents had purchased for me in Paris when I was 16. It occurred to me that it would have been more prudent to wear a Russian cap than one with the French label sewn inside. The elevator rose under my feet. I counted the floors as they went by. 1, 2. We glided to a stop at the third floor. The operator reached for the brass grill and with an effort dragged it back, then pushed open the heavy hall door and held it for me as if I were a guest at the Ritz.
Room 23,
he said, nodding in the direction of a door at the far end of the corridor. I started down the brightly lighted hallway, walking on a worn runner, past an open freight elevator with padded walls, past fine wooden doors with brass numbers on them, until I came to the one with 23 on it. And then, as if I were paying a civilized visit to a publisher who wanted to engage my services as a translator, I reached out and knocked. What I am recounting does not originate in the lobe of the brain where memory resides. It comes directly from the mind's eye. I relive it as I describe it, or more precisely, I live it as if for the first time. When, on occasion, I recall these awful events, they have the odour of earth at a freshly dug grave. Here is what my heart saw when the man I came to know as interrogator Christoforovich pulled open the door and with a nod invited me into the room. I saw Joseph Stalin peering at me from a huge photograph on the wall. I saw Christoforovich grinning inanely at me like a maître d'hôtel. I saw a man who resembled, no more than resembled, the poet Mandelstam, standing next to an absurd stool, whose front legs were shorter than its hind legs, clinging with both hands to the waistband of his dishevelled trousers to keep them from falling to his ankles. I stumbled across the room and crushed his body, trembling from head to foot with soundless sobs, into my trembling arms. I should add here that the stench of urine emanated from his clothing.
"As you can see, Madame Mandelstam, your husband is alive and well," the interrogator said.
Settling onto a chair behind a large table, he pushed aside a half-eaten dinner and motioned for Mandelstam to sit. My husband clung to my hand as he sank onto the stool.
"Are they letting you go?"
he asked in a voice that I didn't recognize as coming from anyone I knew.
What do you mean, letting me go?
Have you forgotten? I visited you in your cell, Nadenka. You and Zinaida.
He beckoned for me to crouch next to him so that his mouth was near my ear.
When they arrested her, they arrested the epigram that I wrote out for her.
My name, the maître d'hôtel announced from behind the table, is Christoforovich. I have the honour of being your husband's interrogator. He is slightly disoriented, as you can see, due most certainly to the shock of seeing you.
He turned to Mandelstam.
Your wife, along with your wife's friend, the actress Zinaida Zaitseva Antonova, were never taken into protective custody.
You are lying, of course,
Mandelstam said, in a voice that sounded more like the one I remembered.
I saw them both in prison.
He is telling the truth, Osya. You must have dreamed it. I have been in our flat in Herzenhaus these past 2 weeks.
Christoforovich cleared his throat.
You have been summoned, he informed me, to hear Mandelstam's sentence for having violated Article 58, which covers the offences of anti-Soviet propaganda and counter-revolutionary activities. Your husband's poem is a counter-revolutionary document without precedent.
The interrogator extracted a sheet of paper from the bulging folder on the table.
Comrade Stalin has reviewed the case personally and instructed the organs to isolate and preserve the prisoner. He is sentenced to 3 years of -12 exile.
What does that mean, -12? Mandelstam asked.
It means you are not permitted to reside in any of the Soviet Union's 12 major urban centres,
Christoforovich said. My husband's grip on my hand tightened, and he began to shake uncontrollably.
I am not to be shot.
You won't be shot, I told him. You will live to compose beautiful poems by the dozen.
I am not to be shot, he repeated,
as if he hadn't heard my response.
Rest assured you will not be subjected to the highest measure of punishment,
Christoforovich said. He looked directly at me.
Is it your desire to go into exile with your husband?
No,
Mandelstam answered for me. Absolutely, I said, overruling him.
Which will it be?
Christoforovich demanded.
I most certainly will accompany my husband into exile.
In that case, I will draw up the necessary papers and bring them to you for signature.
He came around the desk and stood over Mandelstam.
Considering the counter-revolutionary nature of your crime, the sentence represents an incredible act of clemency from the very highest level. Count your blessings.
With that, he left the room, closing the door behind him. His lips quivering, Mandelstam started to speak.
Be careful what you say, I whispered. They are surely listening.
And I glanced at the walls in the classic gesture indicating microphones could have been functioning in them.
Did you deny being arrested because he was in the room?
No, it's the truth. I have been home all this while.
And Zinaida?
After days and days of phoning, I succeeded in getting her on the line. Her voice was strained. I suppose it was because she and her husband are divorcing. She assured me she had destroyed the copy of the epigram you wrote out for her.
He shook his head in confusion.
If her voice was strained, it's because they arrested her copy of the epigram, and she was afraid to admit it.
Christoforovich showed it to me. There was no mistaking it. It was the first version, before Pasternak got me to change the second stanza. I recognized the handwriting as my own.
I don't understand.
Nor do I understand. Believe me, I am not hallucinating. I visited you and Zinaida in prison, for God's sake.
And I tell you, you imagined it. Dear God, what else did you imagine?
Mandelstam mumbled something in Greek.
Ekai egnokamen kata saka Christen.
I recognized the phrase instantly, as we had often tried to decipher these mysterious words of St. Paul's in 2 Corinthians. Paul is said never to have crossed paths with the Christ, yet he claims, "We have known Christ after the flesh." I didn't understand what Mandelstam was getting at by quoting Paul. "Are you trying to tell me you saw Christ in the flesh in prison?" I asked. He shook his head in annoyance, then looked over at the photograph of Joseph Stalin on the wall behind the interrogator's table.
"I saw him."
I still didn't understand. "Stalin came to see you in prison?" My thick-headedness was beginning to irritate my husband.
"Not in prison. And he didn't come to me. I went to him. I saw him in the Kremlin, of course. In the flesh. He offered me a cigarette. We talked. He told me many things about himself, including..."
He pressed his lips against my ear again.
"Including that he shot his wife after an argument. Oh, it wasn't entirely his fault. She produced the pistol. She pushed it into his hand. She dared him to prove that he was as hard as Ivan the Terrible. So he thrust the muzzle to her heart and pulled the trigger. Everyone in the Kremlin is convinced she committed suicide. Only I know the truth."
I couldn't think how to respond. Was it possible that Stalin had brought my husband to the Kremlin and confided in him? If he had confided in him, if he had admitted shooting his wife, why would he now send Mandelstam into exile, where he could repeat the story to anybody who would listen? No, no. The only explanation that made any shred of sense was that Mandelstam, on the door sill of a nervous breakdown, had imagined seeing me and Zinaida in a prison cell, and imagined the conversation with Stalin. "Listen carefully, my darling," I said, breathing my message into his ear. "You must not tell a living soul about having encountered Stalin in the Kremlin. I have no doubt it happened as you said. But if you spread the story about how his wife died, he will have you brought back to Volubianka in chains. Do you understand what I'm saying, Osya?" He kneaded his beautiful forehead with his knuckles.
"Yes."
"Are you sure you understand?" I repeated. He nodded slowly. "Good. Never mention it again. To yourself, to Akhmatova, to Pasternak, to your brother, even to me."
"I shall never mention it again," he said in a small voice.
"We must put the past behind us and concentrate on the future."
"Is the future behind us or ahead of us?"
For an instant I thought Mandelstam had come to his senses and was making a typically mordant, not to mention poetic, observation. Then I sank back on my heels and saw his eyes gaping wide, hungering for the answer to the question he had posed. "The future," I replied, "is ahead of us." Mandelstam accepted this clarification with another slow nod of his head. The maître d'hôtel returned to the room, bringing with him forms in triplicate for me to sign. I scratched my name at the bottom of each page without bothering to read it. What more could I lose that hadn't already been taken from me? Using the side of his table as a straight edge, Christopher Orvich tore off a scrap of paper and wrote the name of a train station, the track number, and the time of departure on it.
"Mandelstam will be sent into exile in the town of Cherdin in the northern Urals," he said. "You have 7 hours to collect what belongings you can carry and join your husband in the railway carriage."
As I started toward the door, I had no time to lose if I was to prepare for the journey. Mandelstam bounded to his feet.
"A swallow!"
he howled, pointing to the pleated curtains covering the window, with the hand that wasn't holding up his trousers. "What is it you see, Osya?"
"I see the future crashing into a mountainside."
I turned on the interrogator and began ranting. "A poet has been driven insane," I cried. "This is a major offence against the government you represent. A poet is being sent into exile in a state of madness."
Christopher Orvitch remained unfazed in the face of Mandelstam's madness and my tirade.
"You will use the time remaining before the departure of the train to better advantage, if you calm yourself and start to prepare for the trip,"
he told me coldly.
I am afraid the images in my mind's eye blur at this point of the narrative. I seem to remember that Mandelstam was weeping as I tore myself away from the room. I have no memory of how I got back to Herzenhaus. None at all. I don't remember phoning Achmatova, but I must have, because within minutes several of the younger poets who lived in the small rooms on the second floor turned up to help me pack. I remember feeling as if I were running a high fever. In this delirious condition, I crammed my husband's clothing, some of it reeking of camphor, into the suitcase that had served as a coffee table. I packed my own clothes in a cardboard suitcase that someone gave me. I threw saucepans and porcelain bowls and kitchen utensils and linen into a canvas mail sack. I filled a small carton with books from Mandelstam's shelves. Pasternak turned up with a thick wad of rubles attached by a rubber band. He said half was from him, half from Achmatova. Looking more mournful than usual, he kissed me on the forehead and fled from the flat. Bulgakov's wife, Elena Sergeyevna, couldn't contain her tears when she knocked on the door. She literally emptied her purse on the kitchen table and forced me to accept every last ruble in it. The wives of two editors who had been unable to publish Mandelstam's poems also came by, one with two knitted winter scarves, the other with cash. "Consider it a loan," she insisted when I tried to push the rubles back into her hand. Two of the young poets who had spent evenings around our kitchen table listening to Mandelstam read aloud from Stone, his first book of poetry, flagged down a government automobile and offered the chauffeur a large gratuity to take me to the train station. They insisted on accompanying me to carry the suitcases and the canvas sack and the carton filled with books. Clutching to my breast a tattered handbag filled with more cash than we'd possessed in years, the two young poets trailing along the quay behind me with our pathetic belongings, I caught sight of my husband in a compartment. He appeared as pale and one-dimensional as the reflection you see in the smudged window of a storefront. Fleeting images of the trip into exile at Cherdin. It took 3 nights and 2 days for the train and the riverboat to cover the roughly 1,500 kilometres, run through my mind's eye like one of those motion pictures where the frames jump on the projector's sprockets. Achmatova, quoting an English poet whose name escapes me, often spoke of fragments shored up against one's ruin. What I am about to recount are fragments of my ruin. Except for the three armed soldiers, one of whom was always posted outside the door to keep other passengers away, Mandelstam and I had the compartment and its 6 berths to ourselves. The senior guard, also named Osip, was a country boy with a broad open face who hummed roundelays when he wasn't grinning at me. He filled my teapot with boiling water from the carriage samovar whenever I asked him, and so I was able to keep my husband supplied with tea, though I'd forgotten to scrounge for sugar at Herzenhaus, and he pulled a face at every sip. Mandelstam spent hours on end with his forehead pressed against the pane, fogging the window with his breath, staring through his reflection at the tiger and the villagers hurtling past, listening intently to the almost human voice of the rails under the wheels of the train.
"Can't you hear it?" he demanded,
and he deciphered the words for me.
"Age before beauty, talent before mediocrity, urban intellectual before rural hick."
On another occasion I came awake to find him talking to himself. I remember him saying the same thing again and again, something like,
They want to get me away from Moscow before they shoot me. They want me to vanish without a trace.
Osip the guard must have overheard him, because still grinning he turned to me and said, "Tell him to calm down, missus. We don't shoot people for making up rhymes, only for spying and sabotage. We're not like the bourgeois countries. There you could be strung up for writing stuff they don't like."
The frames jumped to other images. At some point during that first night, the train pulled onto a siding, and we had to transfer to an open carriage. The guards slung their rifles across their backs and carried our belongings, on a narrow gauge line. Mandelstam and I sat on the wooden benches facing each other. The guards sat across the aisle and kept other passengers at a distance with waves of their hands. What people made of the two gloomy city folks, their suitcases and belongings piled on the overhead rack, I cannot say. Seeing that we were escorted by armed soldiers, everyone avoided eye contact. Everyone except for one person, a thin, elegantly dressed older woman who looked as if she had stepped off the pages of a Turgenev novel. Oh, God, it all comes back to me. I haven't thought of her in years. She boarded the carriage at a remote station, dressed as my mother, rest her soul, used to dress for weddings, in a high-collared, cream-coloured garment and a small straw hat and crocheted gloves. She held a folded lace parasol under one arm and a covered straw hamper in one hand. She looked at me, then at the soldiers, then back at me, and, having grasped that we were prisoners being escorted into exile, she favoured me with the saddest smile you are likely to see in a lifetime. She started down the aisle toward us, oblivious to the soldiers waving her off, oblivious to Osip the guard, rising to his feet with one hand fingering the butt of an enormous revolver. Opening the lid of her hamper, she rummaged under a foulard and produced two cucumbers. She offered one to my husband, the other to me. My husband, shaken out of his stupor by this bold act of solidarity, rose and kissed her hand in the French manner, his bloodless lips grazing the back of her glove. And, with the courteous inclination of her head, this guardian angel of deported prisoners, this relic from a dying Russia, turned and made her way to a seat beside a family of peasants at the far end of the carriage, from where she never lifted her gaze from me. I must have dozed when I was no longer physically able to keep my eyes open. As the train was pulling out of another remote station, I shook myself awake to find the woman's seat at the end of the car vacant. To this day, I bitterly regret not knowing her name, though given what she had done for us, it would have put her in jeopardy to ask. Mandelstam, for his part, never stopped staring at his reflection in the window. He was sure he would be executed at any moment, and didn't want to be caught unawares. The season of white nights had begun, and one could glimpse copses of birches and aspens on the foothills. I drifted off again, but was woken before dawn by the lack of motion of the train. We'd pulled onto another siding in a freight yard to let pass red cattle wagons transporting prisoners to forced labor camps in Siberia. Women had pushed scraps of nylon undergarments between the planks of the wooden siding so people spotting the wagons would understand the nature of their cargo. In my imagination, I see these scraps flying like regimental banners in the chilly penumbra between white night and first light. Late on the second day, with the Ural Range rising like a smudge on the horizon, the train crawled through a suburb of brightly painted one-story frame houses and narrow dirt streets into a run-down terminal with giant likenesses of Lenin and Stalin pasted onto billboards and Solikamsk printed over the swinging doors leading to the station's waiting room. A news bulletin echoed from loudspeakers rigged to posts on the platform. "The spies, traitors, and turncoats have been swept from the face of the earth." Our three trusty guards transported us and our possessions to an open truck parked around the side next to the public toilets. Mandelstam and I were ordered onto bales of straw in the back, and with a belch of exhaust, the truck headed due north along the city's single boulevard. Within minutes, the frame houses gave way to dense woods, and daylight was replaced by impenetrable shadows. Soon after, we pulled up in a clearing, and the truck filled with forestry workers hitching rides to the river. One of them in particular terrified Mandelstam, a big bearded man in a dark red shirt carrying a double-bladed axe on one shoulder. Fearing for his life, my husband began to tremble.
"They're going to behead me as in Peter's time," he gasped.
I hugged him to me and attempted to calm him, but he eyed the bearded giant with dread.
"Expect the worst," he told me. "Do everything possible to keep your dignity. When they come for me, I must absolutely run for it. It is important to escape or die in the attempt."
I recall saying, "At least if they kill us, we won't have to commit suicide." This elicited a nervous giggle from Mandelstam.
"How can I live with a professional suicide like you next to me?" he demanded.
What I didn't say, what I thought was, "If you decide to die, I won't need to kill myself. My life will simply stop." I remember his taking several deep breaths, which calmed him, but he never took his eyes off the bearded lumberjack and his double-bladed axe. The sun had gone down by the time the truck reached the rickety pier on the Kalvar River. Even the white night was lost in the shadows of the forest that descended almost to the water's edge. Voices of women singing on the far bank echoed through the woods. The foresters disappeared into a barrack-like building on a low bluff over the river. The three guards piled our belongings on the pier and sat down with their backs against the pilings, smoking cigarettes and talking in undertones. I knocked on the window of the small store next to the barrack and managed to purchase several tins of sardines, along with a loaf of bread, and, to my husband's delight, two packets of cheap Turkish cigarettes. We settled onto the grassy slope next to the pier, listening to the delicate sounds a river produces at night, the murmur of eddying water, the splash of fish, the croak of frogs. In other circumstances it would have been an agreeable interlude. Mandelstam passed the first Turkish cigarette under his nostrils, savouring the odour, then wedged it between his lips and struck a match. His hand was shaking too much to manoeuvre the flame to the tip of the cigarette, so I lit a second match, and he held my wrist and brought the cigarette to the fire. He exhaled and sank back on the grass.
"I held Stalin's wrist when he lit my cigarette," he said absently. God only knows how I forced a smile onto my face. And in the darkness, I could see him staring at me as if I were a stranger.
Shortly after midnight, the river steamer, an ancient vessel with a naked lady for bowsprit and a lopsided pilot house leaning into the wind high above the main deck, tied up alongside the feeble electric lights at the end of the pier. I found the purser in his office off the midship passageway, and, dipping into the wealth of cash in my purse, purchased tickets that entitled us to a cabin all to ourselves, even a toilet with a small tin tub. Mandelstam could not believe our good fortune when the steward unlocked the door with a skeleton key and stepped back to let us pass, almost as if we were vacationers on a cruise to Chedin. Our three soldiers installed our belongings under the two beds in the cabin and went in search of the bunk rooms reserved for steerage passengers. The smell of cooked cabbage emanated from the galley at the end of the passageway. Mandelstam pronounced himself dismayed at my familiarity with nautical terminology, and for the price of several cigarettes we were able to have our meals brought to the cabin. Before long, the shriek of the ship's whistle filled the night. The deck began vibrating under our feet as the steamer drifted away from the pier and started upriver toward our destination. I can say without exaggeration that we both got our first good sleep in days, so much so that I was quite frightened in the morning to see how still Mandelstam lay in his bunk. I watched him closely to reassure myself that he was still breathing before slipping under his blanket to awaken him with the warmth of my body. He clung to me as a drowning man clings to a life preserver, and I thought, I wasn't certain, mind you, it was only an impression, that I felt the dampness of tears on my neck. And then, I record this detail along with the pain it caused me at the time. Despite the pain it causes me now, I heard him say, "With any luck, I may still have a muse." With or without your leave, I shall skip ahead several hours. Mandelstam bathed, shaven, by me while he sat in the tub, his knobby knees jutting from the water. I didn't yet feel comfortable letting him have a straight-edged razor in his hand. Attired in clothing that smelled of camphor, one of the new knitted scarves wound around his neck was taking the air on the narrow main deck, strolling from where I was sitting in a lounger to the forecastle and back again, his copy of Pushkin open in his hand, but his attention riveted on the shoreline. And with good reason. Stalin's transgression against humanity, forcing peasants who survived the man-induced famine and the execution squads onto agricultural collectives, had uprooted masses of people and scattered them across what had become a wasteland. My husband and I had seen traces of the calamity returning to Moscow from the Crimea, the trip that left an indelible mark on Mandelstam and turned him, for better or worse, into a truth-teller. Friends travelling south or east from Moscow reported coming across survivors searching desperately for a village to settle in or a plot of land to work, all the while trying to evade the squads of Czechists who were combing the countryside. Now, from the deck of our riverboat, we could see the detritus of collectivization camping at the edge of both banks of the river. Clusters of lost souls huddled under tarpaulins stretched from branches over their heads, cartons and straw trunks piled around them, naked children playing in the shallow water while their parents cooked scraps of horse meat, hacked from dead carcasses on charcoal fires. And my befuddled best friend and husband, his brain awash with hallucinations of having visited me in a Lubyanka cell, of having encountered Stalin in the Kremlin, turned to me, and pointing a quivering finger at the shore, cried out, "See, Nadenka, the shortage is being divided amongst the peasants." To the eternal shame of Russia, he was right. What can one say about this episode after all these years? If, as Mandelstam insisted, Stalin knew what his Czechists were doing, he was surely condemned for eternity to the circle of hell, where, as Dante tells us, the fires are so searing one could use molten glass to cool one's body. If, as Pasternak suspected, Stalin didn't know, he was guilty of not knowing what he should have known, and will wind up in the same inferno. At mid-afternoon, Cherdin loomed around a bend in the Kalvar, sprawling over several hills, each surrounded by forest, the whole dominated by the bell tower of an enormous cathedral that had surely been converted by the Bolsheviks into a warehouse. Mandelstam stood on the bow, his palm on the rump of the naked spirit, watching as the steamer turned in the current and drifted down on the cement wharf, piled high with bales and crates, waiting to be transported back to civilization. Catching the heaving lines thrown by crewmen, stevedores dragged the heavy hawsers through the water and up onto bollards. When the ship was fast to the wharf and the gangway secured at midship, the three guards, carrying our possessions, escorted us to an open carriage drawn by a skeletal mare, and followed along on foot behind as we slowly made our way through an enormous gate into the citadel at the center of the city. The commandant, an old cavalryman from the look of his high boots and flamboyant moustache, was hastily fastening the tarnished gold buttons of his tunic as we were led into his office. He sharpened the ends of his moustache with his fingers.
"You will be the Mandelstams," he said. "The telegram from Moscow failed to mention a first name or patronymic. Which one of you is the prisoner?"
"It's me, the prisoner," my husband said. "I am the poet Mandelstam."
"And I am Nadezhda Yakovlevna, the wife of the poet Mandelstam," I said, my pride at being connected to Mandelstam overcoming my resentment, which I tended to suppress, at his having gotten us into this predicament.
"Very unusual,"
the commandant, who never bothered introducing himself, observed. "What is very unusual?" I inquired.
"The notation isolate and preserve, next to the name Mandelstam on the telegram," he replied. "It is the first time I have come across such instructions."
He looked directly at Mandelstam.
"Whom do you know in the Kremlin?"
My husband's lips fashioned themselves into what, on another occasion, could reasonably have been described as a smile.
"Stalin," he replied.
The commandant exchanged quick looks with his young deputy, sitting behind a desk across the room.
"This is not something you should joke about," he warned. "What makes you think I am joking?"
Apparently deciding it would be more prudent to drop the matter, the commandant announced that we were to be housed in the local district hospital until our final place of exile was decided upon. This was the first inkling we had that Cherdyn was to be a way station for us. The same carriage transported us up a winding road, paved with split logs, to a brick structure that had been converted, so we learned, from a sausage factory into a hospital. Our three guards bid us farewell at the gate. The one called Osip actually stood to attention and saluted after turning us over to the hospital authorities. A heavy-set woman wearing a soiled white smock led us to a large, empty second-floor ward, with two metal army carts set at right angles to one wall. As nobody offered to assist us with our baggage, I had to make several trips to the lobby and haul everything upstairs myself. With the departure of our three guards, who Mandelstam thought were under orders to execute him, my husband relaxed ever so slightly. He noticed a portrait of Lenin that had been torn from a magazine, thumb-tacked to the back of the ward door, and this sparked a memory.
"When the Reds took power," he said, "the wife of one of the Bolsheviks came to the flats of writers to pin portraits of Lenin cut from magazines to our walls. She hoped it would save the intelligentsia. How innocent she was."
He shook his head.
"How innocent we all were."
As night settled over Cherdyn, Mandelstam started to hear voices again. I knew this was the case from the wild look in his eyes. He became convinced he had heard Akhmatova reciting a line from one of her poems. "They take my shadow for questioning," and concluded from this that she had been arrested and shot. We were summoned to supper in the canteen on the main floor, but Mandelstam flatly refused to eat anything until he had searched the ravines around the hospital for Akhmatova's corpse. I followed him along the dirt paths that ran through the woods around the hospital until the two of us were stumbling from exhaustion. Only then was I able, pushing and tugging, to get him back up to the second-floor ward and onto his cart. By the time I made it down to the canteen, the only food available was leftovers. But, as they correctly say, beggars cannot be choosers. So I scraped some gristly meat and cold potatoes onto a clean plate and brought it up to my husband, who picked at the scraps with a remarkable absence of enthusiasm. I have reached the part of the story that causes my heart to splinter. It's as if... as if reliving this episode has something in common with dying. Mandelstam was sitting up on his cot, fully dressed, his spinal cord against the wall, listening with his eyes, muttering about how the woodcutters were going to execute him when the moon was high enough for them to find their way through the forest. I was determined not to close my eyes until he fell asleep, but, overcome with fatigue, I must have drifted off. I dreamed terrible dreams of alligators plucking children out of the shallow water along the river bank while their parents fanned the flames of charcoal fires and turned makeshift spits with dead humans on them. The nightmare jolted me awake. The cot next to me was empty. The glass door leading to a narrow balcony was open. I caught sight of the poet Mandelstam in the light of the moon. He was sitting astride the balustrade, one leg dangling over the side, two floors above the ground, working up the courage to jump. From the glass door I whispered his name, in order not to startle him. He turned his head and gasped at me, his eye sockets dark with terror. I lunged for him and caught hold of the back of his jacket, but he squirmed out of the sleeves and dropped into the darkness. I stood there in the icy night, clutching the jacket in my hands for the time it takes the image on the retina to reach the brain. Then I screamed a scream so piercing it frightened birds into the night sky. I don't recall how I made it down the wide flight of steps to the ground floor, only of standing in the garden at the foot of the hospital wall as figures carrying kerosene lamps rushed from the entrance. People in white smocks were pulling Mandelstam, moaning in pain, from the hedge into which he had fallen. They set him on a stretcher and had to pry me off his body in order to carry him back into the hospital. I staggered along behind. We wound up in the operating block, lighted by candles, because the generator was switched off at night to save fuel. A woman doctor, wearing a bathrobe and clearly disgruntled at having been woken up, directed the nurses to strip Mandelstam naked. Her eyeglasses slipping along her nose, she examined his right shoulder and arm, which were twisted out of shape and blue with bruises. "He is fortunate," the doctor said, probing my husband with the tips of her fingers. "He has dislocated his shoulder socket." And with that, she took hold of Mandelstam's wrist and gave it a sharp tug, setting the bone back into the socket. My husband's shriek of pain was cut short when he fainted. By the time he regained consciousness, his shoulder and torso had been bandaged, and he was back in his cot, his arm in a sling, a blanket pulled up to his chin. "What happened?" he asked, when the effect of the sedative wore off. "You fell, my darling Osya. Luckily you landed in hedges which broke your fall. The ground underneath had been recently turned to make a flower bed. You dislocated your shoulder. The doctor said it will be some weeks before you regain full use of your right arm." After Mandelstam's attempt at suicide, I have no memory of time, only of light. Sunlight, white night, candlelight, moonlight, even starlight. Days folded themselves into one another. The nurses, moved by our plight, turned out to be very caring. They changed my husband's bandages, and sponged his limbs, and emptied the bedpan, and brought up meals from the canteen, so I wouldn't be obliged to leave him alone in the ward. Perhaps a week went by. I honestly can't say. What I do remember is that on a sun-drenched morning, two male nurses turned up in the ward carrying a sturdy chair, on which they proposed to carry Mandelstam downstairs. I never understood why, but he broke into a cold sweat and began shaking his head emphatically, and nothing I said could convince him to submit to their ministrations. He ended up descending the staircase, leaning his weight on me, and wincing in pain with each step. Once downstairs, Mandelstam was lifted, along with our possessions, into the back of a hand-drawn cart, which two strapping peasant boys contrived to drag down the road, paved with split logs, to the citadel. The commandant, wearing coveralls this time, received us in his office.
"I guess you do have a friend in the Kremlin," he said, shaking his head in disbelief. "I have received a telegram with instructions you are to be permitted to select your place of exile. It can be anywhere except one of the 12 biggest cities."
Who was our friend in the Kremlin? Had Pasternak prevailed upon Bukharin to intervene after all? Had the head of the Writers' Union, Maxim Gorky, picked up rumblings of discontent from the poets and passed them on to Yagoda? Had Stalin himself, surely the one behind the order to isolate and preserve, decided that Mandelstam would be unlikely to survive a winter immediately under the Arctic Circle? Offered a choice, Mandelstam didn't hesitate.
"Voronezh," he announced,
as if he had anticipated the question.
"Why Voronezh?" the commandant asked.
The choice surprised me, too. "Why Voronezh, Osya?" Mandelstam thought about this. "I knew a biologist at Tashkent University who was born in Voronezh, a frontier town in the time of Peter the Great, populated with escaped convicts. He told me good things about it. As the city is on the Don and south of Moscow, the weather will be milder than here.
I remember the biologist saying his father worked as a prison doctor there."
And then, miracle of miracles, the old Mandelstam, that high-strung, headstrong, life-glad homo poeticus who was able to find a grain of humour in the darkest situation, reincarnated himself in the commandant's office of the citadel at Cherdin. He looked at me, a hint of a smile playing in his eyes, and he said, "We cannot rule out the possibility that we may need the services of a prison doctor, can we, Nadenka?" "Welcome back," I said.